You just said we wouldn't do that. You just said. You just said that we wouldn't.
I didn't think she had time to pull it off.
It's Twin Cities News Talk. It's the
I always have Drew time and, to torture John.
Drew and Sam show. I'm going to go off and do my own thing. Drew started singing the song a moment ago.
I went to go get coffee.
Oh, yeah. They pump the stations in the out in the lobby on the way to the bathroom.
It's kind of an earworm of a song.
I hate this song. Which is odd, because usually this is the kind of garbage that I would like. But this song is just so, it's just redundant and obvious. Yes, lightning then thunder. We know that.
Thunder. Feel the thunder.
Yeah.
Lightning.
Yeah. It's not great. But
thanks for the weather tip. How am I supposed to get emotionally involved in the song? Oh, it's lightning and then there's thunder.
It's got a nice little hook.
Yeah, at least they can add, like, you know, in the thunder, and then you count, then you know how close the storm is, that kind of thing, right? Because the number of seconds you count before the lightning strikes, or the oh, it's lightning, then thunder, and then you know how close the eye of the storm is.
I don't know if that's true.
Aren't you know, that is true, isn't that true?
I don't know. I think it's from Poltergeist. But I don't know. Yeah, I just the only reason I know that is because it was in Poltergeist.
Yeah, it's lightning first, and then you count 1, 2, 3, and then you hear the thunder, and then based off the number that you got, that's how many miles the eye of the storm is away from your house.
Could be an old wives' tale. I thought that was how far that it was. That's how far that particular lightning bolt is hitting. I don't know.
It could be an old wives' tale.
Okay, well, all that's still better than that song. That's my fault. That's
ooh, and blah blah blah.
I know it's my you know
lost
well,
our call.
I know we get paid to go blah blah blah. I'm sorry.
651-989-5855.
Sam for playing horrible bumper music
is the phone number, or use the hashtag TCNT
thunder?
On Twitter.
Thunder.
God, off the rails.
It's not Friday yet, guys.
Second hour.
Are we gonna have our guest on? Or
I'm trying.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, okay. You are calling. All right. Out of the Star Tribune, we'll give you just some details while we try to get David Gartensteiner Ross on the phone. An unprecedented cluster of Minnesotans aspiring to become jihadists overseas has fueled the nation's highest rate of terrorism recruitment, according to a new study that also found that attempts to travel to Syria and Iraq are on a steady decline since 2015. The researchers of George Washington's University program on extremism found that Minnesota, particularly the Twin Cities, has seen an unusually active rate of jihadist mobilization, with roots in an earlier wave of departures to join Somalia's al-Shabaab militants in the late 2000s. The report, done by Alexander Hitchens, Hughes, and Bennett Clifford, looked at 7 Minnesota cases of successful travelers who were part of a group of 64 Americans who traveled to join jihadist groups in Syria and Iraq since 2011. They found at least another 50 Americans who were stopped from trying to travel overseas, and added that both the data sets pale in comparison to recruitment from some European cities. There's an interesting piece, too, that we'll get to, hopefully when we get Devine on the phone, from the New Yorker, that talks about how effective those Americans joining the fight have actually been. In the story here, it does say, though, the concern is that absent a physical space to travel to, their focus will shift somewhere to avenging the loss of the Islamic State, according to Hughes. We've seen Islamic State propaganda romanticizing the lost caliphate and calling for those to commit acts out of revenge. Not to mention that, I don't know if it's along these lines, but today there was a story about ISIS releasing a propaganda video essentially saying that there were jihadists waiting to the west of Paris ready to strike, and that's been making some headlines today.
Joining us now from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, our counterterrorism expert, David Gartenstein-Ross. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good to join you.
We've talked with you a number of times about the issue of terror recruiting here in Minnesota, and it doesn't seem to have abated at all. You know, we've touched on this before, but I'd like to hear your thoughts again on why Minnesota seems to be such a hotbed.
So there have been ebbs and flows. The first significant rise in recruitment from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area occurred after the late 2006 Ethiopian invasion of Somalia. At the time, there was a fundamentalist movement called the Islamic Courts Union that had captured the majority of southern Somalia. The Ethiopians were supporting the transitional federal government, which was recognized by the UN. And as the Islamic Courts Union was on the verge of wiping out the transitional government in the city of Baidoa. The Ethiopians came in. There was an intervention. It stirred up a lot of nationalist passions for reasons related to the Ethiopia-Somalia relationship. And by 2008-2009, it was clear that a number of young men from Minneapolis-St. Paul had gone over, who were of Somali origin primarily, had gone over to Somalia to fight in that battle. At the time, there was this kind of mixed view in the community. Some people viewed it through a nationalist lens and were very supportive of the fight against the Ethiopians. Others were much more skeptical of what was a jihadist organization, Shabab, which later became an al-Qaeda affiliate, recruiting in the midst. But eventually, you know, Minnesotans in the Somali community saw young men in their community going over to Somalia and fighting and dying and sometimes being killed by Shabab itself. You know, during this period, unfortunately, a young man who was a graduate of Roosevelt High School named Sherwa Ahmed became the U.S.'s first suicide bomber, dying over in the Horn of Africa theater. Now, when the community saw that happen, there was a sea change in terms of how people viewed recruitment in their midst. The community started to cooperate more with law enforcement. But then you got a second mobilization at the time that ISIS arose, based in large part on social networks. But it seems as though some of the initial infrastructure that helped the first wave never actually went away, which is one reason why when the second wave came, Minneapolis-St. Paul emerged as a hotspot again, which, as the George Washington report that you referenced says, that doesn't really fit the pattern of U.S. recruitment. Generally speaking, you have smaller cells in the U.S. than in Europe, but here you have a very intensely social networked cell in Minneapolis-St. Paul, which, you know, helped recruitment in both of these two waves that I described.
When we ask the question of, like, well, why? We guess the why is this happening, and I know that's what you've been detailing. But is it as simple to say that it's cyclical? It's cyclical in nature because of the demographics of the population here, because of the individuals that have left, gone overseas, and what has happened, and it's just been a cycle that continues, and perhaps that's why it hasn't died down and it has continued to perpetuate.
Well, in both of those cycles, there's something specific that caused it to die down. In the later cycle, and the George Washington report records, from after 2015, a drop in recruitment, is that, you know, ISIS was losing on the battlefield, and Turkey in particular tightened travel into Syria, which made it more difficult for people to reach Syria. That helped to reduce the amount of people going abroad to join ISIS. In the case of Shabab, you had, you know, Shabab's nature revealed much more clearly, with Minnesotans dying as suicide bombers, Minnesotans being killed by allegedly their own side when they started to get cold feet about their participation in the conflict. So there are specific things that have reduced it. Now, I mean, the harder question, and the one that you're raising and I'm actually not directly answering, is the why Minneapolis-St. Paul?
Sure.
And, you know, the reason why I'm not going into that quite as much is because I'm very aware of kind of the nature of what I study, right? I study networks. I study militant groups. And, you know, my knowledge drops off, and obviously there are lots of answers that are easy to give, but my knowledge drops off when it comes to looking at the local conditions that give rise to that.
Sure.
That's something where people who are part of Minneapolis-St. Paul, who understand community demographics and community relationships and the like and live with them every day, will have views that are somewhat more informed as what the underlying drivers are. I understand the networks. You all understand the locality better than I do.
Well, we'll get back to the locality part of it on a different path here in just a moment, because we have a couple of recent stories, the federal terrorism charges for a former St. Catherine student. We have the Mall of America stabbing suspect, yeah, pledge allegiance to ISIS. We'll get to that in a moment. To the Americans going overseas, I just want to ask you a question based off of this article that came out just recently from the New Yorker. And it essentially was breaking down that and saying that Americans were joining ISIS But in the majority, never saw any combat during the ISIS 3-year rule, and they went so far as to say they were marginal players in the caliphate. Have you seen that article? Are you aware of what's referenced there?
Yeah, I'm aware of the article, and I've also studied this through a lot of primary source documents, so I've been able to see that myself.
Is that an accurate statement? Is there anything from that article that relates to the individuals here in Minneapolis that perhaps went and joined the fight there?
Well, I mean, it's sad to see something where the USA is not number one, right? Like, I had to put my foam finger away and. Yeah, I mean, the Americans have not been frontline fighters, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is linguistic. ISIS is broken down into language groups, and based on demographics, both the Arabic language group and the French language group are more prevalent in ISIS than the English language group. So there have been prominent English language fighters for ISIS. They tended to be British rather than American. Secondly, I think social networks are just disadvantageous to Americans. One thing that, as we talked about, Minneapolis-St. Paul, which, Minnesota has been responsible for over 25% of the foreign fighters who've gone over. It's the exception, though. Generally speaking, the U.S. does not have that level of recruitment, whereas you can find a number of European cities that have much more recruitment, like Brussels, Paris, and elsewhere. You can find places with a lot more recruitment than you can find in Minneapolis, St. Paul. So social networks are disadvantageous. And then the third thing is that kind of the climate, not just the temperature and weather, but also just the terrain. It's less familiar to Americans. Mm. Than it will be for people who are either from the region or else Europeans who are dual nationals who've spent a lot of time in the Middle East and North Africa. For all those reasons, I think Americans have not fared as well. And, it's absolutely correct. They haven't been, generally speaking, there are some exceptions to this, but they generally speaking haven't been as high profile or in as prominent of combat roles.
Looking at, there was a story today, this is not Minneapolis, but just looking at a headline today, an American allegedly sent a resume to ISIS for a teaching job. I'm going to sort of probably awkwardly lump that in with our local stories of the charges against the St. Catherine student who said she wanted to burn the school to the ground, the Mall of America stabbing suspect. The first question that I have on these two, and you put the other one in there, is, what are we hoping to glean from these individuals when we take them into custody? Do you think they're being processed in such a way, and the right individuals who have the right knowledge, say, like yourself, are they able to go and ask questions or get information that could be beneficial in our fight against terrorism?
So first of all, in terms of the resume, I should say that there have actually been a number of cases of people sending their resumes to ISIS. That's something we've seen before,
so weird.
And I actually have not seen what the resume looks like when sent to ISIS, but given that I'm probably not going to apply for a job with them, it's perhaps not relevant to me. The answer is yes. Where they can get it, the federal authorities try to produce cooperation.
It feels like a really desperate attempt by LinkedIn to become relevant again.
There goes the endorsement we were working on.
ISIS could always launch a competitor site. We try to encourage startups and entrepreneurship in this country. But at any rate, federal authorities do try to do a few things. Number one, elicit information. And number two, in some cases, and there have been prominent cases, some of which didn't end particularly well, of people who had been radicalized and then take that specialized knowledge and apply it to counter-radicalization efforts. One prominent case was Jesse Morton, who, from all accounts, was very helpful to federal authorities after turning away from Islamic extremism. He'd elicited, made death threats and published the address of Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the South Park creators, back when there was this controversy over an episode that depicted the Prophet Muhammad. But at any rate, Morton's case, after he was released from prison, ended up with him being caught with crack cocaine and a prostitute, which, I mean, and let me be clear, like, I'm not actually judging here. I mean, he got out of prison, which is, you know, and had a number of issues that were psychological. He's trying to kind of make a comeback as a commentator. That's kind of a case which, to some extent, is a warning tale.
Right.
He was vaulted to prominence at a time when I think that prominence kind of ate away at and really destroyed the opportunity that he had. But that being said, I mean, they're looking for ways to take people who may be susceptible to de-radicalization or moving out of the movement and seeing how they can take either their knowledge or, in some cases, their skills and use them for good.
Real quick, before we run out of time this segment, we've got this story here from the St. Catherine student facing federal terrorism charges. 19-year-old arrested after setting several fires on campus, saying she wanted to burn the school down in retribution to the violence that had been done against Muslims in Afghanistan. I don't know if you've been following this story at all, but if you have, were you surprised that that her basically small attempts at arson within this school mounted to federal terrorism charges? And does that indicate you that there might be more to this story than just a disturbed student who set some fires, didn't actually cause a whole lot of harm or damage?
It's hard to say. You know, if this were the Obama administration, I'd say yes, there's definitely more to the story. Because under the Obama administration, they tended not to like to bring federal terrorism charges. There's much more that can be said about that. I'll just caption that. It's not clear in the Trump administration as to whether they want to bring charges more frequently or whether there's more to the story. But what I will say is that these acts clearly, if you look at the federal terrorism statutes and the way in which you could bring a case that has federal terrorism implications, this definitely meets the criterion.
Okay.
So it's not surprising that they could bring it. The bigger question is why they're bringing it as opposed to having local authorities do so.
Senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, author of Bin Laden's Legacy. You can find him at defenddemocracy.org. David Gartensteiner-Ross, as always, man, it was fantastic to talk to you.
Likewise.
We'll take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Just after 7:30, America's for Prosperity, Jason Flores will be joining us in studio, talking about, they got a big event coming up here in, very soon, a matter of days that we'll get to. Next, out of reason, there's still no there in the Russian probe, and a criminal referral that actually backed up Nunes and his dossier claims as the Dems continue to push their memo rebuttal.
Justice in...
I know too much sometimes.
Sorry. I have no one else to share with.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130. Welcome back to your Thursday edition of Justice and Drew. Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity joining us in the next segment. And right on the top of the 8 o'clock hour, lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien. We're going to check in with him and get his thoughts on the case involving Michelle Fischbach and her ability to serve both as senator and lieutenant governor.
Speaking of cases, out of Fox 9, the grand jury process, secretive, and it's gradually unfolding up on the 20th floor inside the government center in Minneapolis. Grand jury process is starting in the Justine Damon case. Now many are asking about Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman's agenda as he continues to probe the July shooting death of Justine Damon. Trial attorney Mike Bryant said, if Mike Freeman decides to charge this, he is going to do this in a way to win this. That's why he's going to get all this testimony down. Nor has refused to give a statement about what he saw and why he pulled the trigger. He can't be compelled at any point up through the trial, said Bryant. It's his constitutional right not to say anything. I know there's a big difference here. As a point, this reminds me a little bit of like the special investigations and the special counsels. You know, where you go searching until you can hit upon the conclusion or a conclusion that you can move forward to go and prosecute. I mean, they convene this grand jury so that they can get this information that they couldn't get before, but that's what it feels like. And I think that's part of the reason why, like in places like California, you can't do grand juries when it comes to police shooting cases.
Yeah, this is clearly an effort by Freeman to get officers on the record. What I found interesting about the story is towards the end, union reps have told reporters that more than 30 officers have been called to testify before the grand jury in the coming days, including his partner, Harity, who was in the car with him at the time, Noor's partner, and many who trained and worked with Noor before the shooting.
Right.
And I think that's going to be the key aspect of this, is what sort of training did Noor get? Because if you remember, a lot of the controversy, speculation, conversation around this was this guy fast-tracked?
Right.
Because Betsy Hodges and Janae Harto wanted a Somali representative on the police force. Did he receive the proper training? I'd heard from people off the record who had said nobody wanted to partner with this guy because they felt he was poorly trained. They felt that he wasn't ready to be in the situation that he was. So he was partnered with Harity, who was a very young rookie green cop himself. So I think that seems to be the focus of what sort of training did this guy have? Was he really ready? Because if that's the case, if it's that, then that's more an indictment on the department overall than it is an indictment on Noor individually.
Sure. I think we're more likely now to actually see if we're going to get any truth about that, right? We're more likely to see it now that former Mayor Betsy Hodges is called former Mayor Betsy Hodges. If she were still serving in office, I think it'd be less likely that we would be able to see any transparency or clarity on Noor's training, right? I think, to your point, if it is on the department and his training, I think the way it will be spun, it'll be interesting to see. Where if it does show that Noor didn't receive proper training, where does that spotlight shine? Does this shine more on the department, or does this shine more on the individual who championed Noor to go and be in that position? You still, you know, have the obvious all political correctness there of making sure you don't go and offend people. But the fact that Betsy Hodges isn't in office anymore, I think it provides a better opportunity to see what takes place. Along the same lines, kind of, there's a story out of the Washington Examiner. Are robot cops the future of efficient, bias-free policing?
Ooh.
Okay?
Ooh, I don't like that.
Well, it's interesting because the concept is outlined in a Ford patent filing for a self-driving cop car capable of using artificial intelligence to find good hiding spots to catch violators of traffic laws. An optional human passenger could override settings that prevent the car from breaking traffic laws itself. Now, it's unclear how far along the idea is in development, but experts and policymakers are grappling with the concept that was quietly filed with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office more than a year ago before recently attracting widespread attention after a blogger noticed it. It's funny, Drew, because in the story, you get further along, it has a libertarian stake in here. And it says, despite talk of frightening consequences, the idea of robotic policing does have supporters. Surprisingly, among some civil libertarians, Ian Adams, Associate Vice President of State Affairs with the Free Market R Street Institute, said predictably from within, policing cuts both ways, but likely cuts favorably overall.
It's going to be very situational. There are some aspects of policing where I think you could effectively deploy this type of technology. Enforcement of traffic laws seems to be like the no-brainer, right? If you're just looking for people who are speeding or running red lights or not stopping at stop signs in intersections that have
super smart cameras are what we used to have.
Yeah, exactly. What we have. I mean, so those areas are sort of where I could see this being effective and working well. There are a lot of areas, though, where you want police officers
sure.
to use that discretion to be able to assess a situation using their judgment and their discretion and talking to people and, you know, you looking at body language and things like that where, you know, that's where I get concerned. I encourage police to use
right.
some degree of discretion in how they're enforcing laws.
One day, this is one day when we're dead and gone. Okay, and I think it's gonna be we're a ways out, right? Maybe when Sam is an old lady, maybe. Okay, but one day when we've got AI doing a majority of law enforcement work. There's going to be two talk show hosts, right, on the air talking about all the complications that have now arisen with bias-free policing. Because when you think about it, right, and I'm going way, way, way down the line, but think about like all of the new territory and new issues that pop up when you have artificial intelligence out enforcing laws and how you get a better picture in terms of you kind of strip away all the bias. But by stripping away all the bias, you're also getting a much clearer picture of crime.
Yeah.
You know, you get further enough down the line, there's a whole new territory of sort of social justice issues that are going to end up popping up. I mean, it starts with what we're seeing now. And it kind of already started with like red light cameras and speed cameras and stuff like that.
In a lot of states and a lot of municipalities, red light cameras have been struck down.
Right.
As being unconstitutional because you didn't have that physical presence of a police officer actually doing their job.
Yep. Yeah. It's very
cameras, things like that.
Yeah, long after we're gone, you know, it's more like Westworld. I don't know what that's about, but I think they have robots in Westworld, right? I haven't watched the show.
Westworld is robots.
Is it all robots? Pretty much, okay, yeah. So it'd be like a world like Westworld.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Without all the violence and the other stuff that goes on in that show.
It's a good show.
I have heard it's a very good show. I've seen snippets.
Just a few weeks.
So excited.
Yeah.
It's really good.
I had to put it on my list.
651-989-5855 is the phone number, or use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. Coming up, Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity joins the show. We'll get their view of what their priority, what they think their priority, the priorities should be going into the next legislative session.
You're listening.
You know, I was talking about the future when we have AI that is, enforcing all of our law enforcement, and I made the comment. Welcome back to Twin Cities News Talk, Justice and Drew, along with Sam. I made the comment that there'll be two talk show hosts that'll be talking about the issues that have now popped up because of AI that's out there and the lack of bias. Somebody said they might strip away bias, but they'll lose empathy. I also was mistaken too in thinking that, you know, the talk show host probably be AI as well.
We're going to be replaced by robots.
Yeah, yeah. We'll be dead by then.
Jeff in Cocado, go ahead.
You guys stole all my thunder.
Oh, sorry.
But the big word that Drew thunder? Used was discretion. You know, how many times are you going to pass, go be going eastbound on a highway and pass a westbound cop, and you're doing 1 mile per hour over the speed limit, he's going to pull you over. You'll never get anywhere. Because the AI is telling him that you're breaking the law and taking his discretion away. They use discretion when it comes to stuff like that.
Yep.
And if it goes away, life is going to suck. And our freedoms are going to
diminish. Yeah. Thank yeah.
Thanks, Jeff. I mean, I imagine when it comes to enforcement of traffic laws, you know, everybody knows police, they give you a little leeway when it comes to speed limits. We did the story, the Pioneer Press did a really extensive piece looking at all traffic violations, and they found that there's, you know, there's about a 10-mile, within a 10-mile per hour sort of comfort zone that most police will give you. I imagine they could sort of program that into the AI.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, if it's just a lot of these traffic laws and traffic enforcement are simply revenue generation, so it could just be a matter of, you know, they're not going to pull you over, but they're going to use the camera technology, get your license plate, and you're going 2 miles an hour over the speed limit, and you're going to get a ticket in the mail 2 days later.
Well, and pulling back the curtain a little bit on what we do. Truth be told, I was working through that story this morning, and I was thinking, oh, this would be good, you know, for a lengthy discussion about, you know, the future of AI and law enforcement and all that. And then I got about halfway through my notes, and I realized this is totally unnecessary. And the reason why it's unnecessary is because by the time we get to a place where you actually have robots, for lack of a better term, robots deployed to enforce law enforcement, let alone specifically traffic laws, we're going to be in such a different place when it comes to modes of transportation. I mean, you may still have some cars on the road with humans driving behind the wheel, but between Uber and Uber wanting to, you know, turn helicopters into, you know, flying Uber cars and self-driving automobiles, I mean, the transportation landscape, I mean, unless the Met Council is still in charge, but the transportation landscape is going to be so drastically different that the type of enforcement that the robots will be doing will be completely different as well. And I mean, well, this is really not, there's too many variables involved when you get that far into the future to know exactly what that enforcement is even going to look like.
Yeah.
I do not want a self-driving car. Can I just say that up front?
You've said that before.
I don't want. I have no. No.
Well, but I would counter with until you experience it.
No, yeah.
You don't know.
Oh, I have. It's called Uber, and I don't like it.
That's not a self-driving car.
Well, it's somebody other than myself driving the car that I am in. So I can just imagine that guy being a robot.
You just hate being a passenger.
I do hate being a passenger. I can't stand being a passenger.
It's weird.
I don't like it at all. I can't.
Some would call that being a control freak.
I mess with my wife all the time because we'll go somewhere and we'll go as a family and we'll take her car. Jason Flores is in studio with us. Good morning, sir. We'll take her car and we'll go to leave. And she'll automatically assume that I'm going to get in the driver's seat and I'll just mess with her head and be like, no, you drive. She'll be like, what? Then you can drive.
If my wife...
You're letting me drive? Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, if my wife was going to drive, then she wouldn't be able to nap or read her book or put her feet up on the dash or any of those, or finish her makeup. Well, she probably does drive and finish her makeup. Sorry, hon. You shouldn't do that, by the way. But I'm the same way. I don't know if I could get it. It'd be like, no, you should merge now. Did you tell the robot to check its blind spot?
Right, right.
How do I know?
Right.
It didn't turn its head.
I can't. I don't. This is the reason. We're getting to the root of why I don't like to fly. I hate being a passenger in a car. Nope. Yeah. Don't like it at all.
I've gotten pretty good at finishing my makeup on the way in, though.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Your forehead's not quite as shiny as it used to be.
Can't even tell.
That's why you get this big beard like I've got. Then you have much less area to have to worry about and cover.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Getting the hard topics here on Justice and Drew.
Get rid of the sheen. Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity. How you doing?
Hey, good. Happy to be here, guys.
Yeah, it's been a little while. Nice to have you back in.
Well, New Year's kicking off. It's time to get going.
That's right. You got a legislative session right around the corner.
We do. I mean, days away. Kind of the traditional kickoff to the election year and the political year with caucuses the other night, and now we turn around and we start session on the 20th of February. So it's going to be a big one, and sessions during the during an election year are always a little more fun. It's just a little more positioning,
yeah,
and then add Dayton's last term on top of it.
Right.
Who really knows what he's going to do? So
he doesn't even know what he's going to do.
It's going to be a pretty volatile one, I would say.
Well, I think it's either going to be volatile or it's going to be nothing. It's going to be a very inactive session.
Oh, I think it's going to be a volatile to very little. and to a point, let me be clear.
Volatile but accomplished nothing.
Right, but and part of that is all right because I think the legislature and the governor actually, if you look at the record, did a lot last session.
Yeah.
You know, that's the big budget year. That's when you're supposed to be doing the bulk of the heavy lifting in figuring out where your priorities are for funding. In between tax relief, new dollars for transportation without any new taxes, they did a lot of good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to be nibbling a little bit around the edges here, but there are still obviously concerns out there and things that need to be addressed right now.
I know that Americans for Prosperity, the work you do, is more focused on policy than elections generally, but
right.
We did just have caucus the other night. I'm curious your reaction to what happened in caucus. Anything surprise you? Anything jump out to you that you are paying particular attention to?
Well, I think the thing that jumped out a little bit with caucuses, and you've seen it a little bit in some of the special elections within the region so far, is that there is a big gap in terms of who's participating in some of these very early on political processes. Mm-hmm. If you look at just the numbers from the caucus on Tuesday evening, there was much more. There's always more Democratic turnout in Minnesota.
There's more,
and I think you could argue that their governor's race is, you know, they have more bigger contests going on. Republicans still haven't figured out if everybody's in the field or not, things like that. So there was more turnout on the Democrat side, but I think there's even a little bit more than you would have expected. And I think a little less on the Republican side. And we've seen that in some special elections too. And I just worry about folks on the right or from a conservative angle being a little complacent, thinking, oh, well, we've got, you know, two bodies in Congress and in DC. We've got the president now. We signed tax reform. We got that done. Maybe they're getting the, and so I don't need to show up and be part of this grassroots movement anymore. And for our purposes at Americans for Prosperity, I would absolutely disagree.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time to be involved. This is the time to make your voice heard. And whether you're voting in a special election next Monday down in Hastings and Cottage Grove, or you're going to take a role with us or another group during the legislative session, this is where you make your voice heard. This is where you make a difference.
We were talking with Jennifer Carnahan, Minnesota GOP chairwoman, yesterday, and about the value of the of the caucus that took place earlier this week. And apart from the actual night, it's funny. In retrospect, I look back and I go, you know, It's the, regardless of how you feel about it, it is important from one particular angle, and that is it almost becomes sort of a bipartisan PR campaign because it kind of gives everybody the opportunity, regardless if people don't get involved that night, but it gets it out in the news and it kind of lets everybody know and it lets average people that may not be paying attention that things are starting off and we are getting into a cycle and it is time to get involved.
Right.
And, you know, we have other things to talk about with you, but then you end up coming in, and it's important that people go out that night, but I do like the fact that it also is kind of a public announcement of, hey, you know, things are beginning now.
The thing that always kind of gets me about the precinct caucuses is you have a lot of people opposed to it because it's fairly low turnout as a percentage of voters. Like, oh, it's the start of this process where a very small group of people selects who the candidates are or who's going to move forward. You know, we saw Paul Thiessen drop out
right
on the DFL side because he got such a low score at the caucus. Well, that population could hardly be deemed as almost as a representative sample. It was similar with my problems with the Iowa caucus and the Iowa straw poll back in the day,
right,
deciding everything for the presidency. You want a bunch of people who are literally paid to go to caucus, in Iowa's case,
sure,
to decide your presidential candidates. It's ludicrous. But my pushback on that is, what more open process do you want? It's publicized. It's state law. It's nonpartisan. It's run not really by a they're organized by political party, but there's no you can get in or you can't get in, or it's located here or not. It's all run by the Secretary of State. You go to the Secretary of State's website to figure out where you're going to go to precinct caucus.
Right.
So there's no more open process. And if you're complaining about who candidates are or what's in your party's platform or what your other activists are talking about, then you have to show up.
Yeah.
And it's that way for caucuses. It's that way during the legislative session. Same for the work that we do. We couldn't do what we do to influence policy, to move it in a certain direction, without our activists showing up and putting in their time, blood, sweat, and tears to make it happen.
Well, and it's supportive, too, because the people that do go in caucus are the ones who, you could make the argument, are the most actively involved. And so I think from the standpoint of, you want to make sure that those people, of all people, stay engaged and continue to get involved. And there's no better way to go and encourage that by going and attending these things if you haven't done it before.
Well, the counter argument to that, I agree generally, but the counter argument to that is, are those people truly representative of the population as a whole? You know, some years, you know, you'll just get the most hardcore of the activist crowd, the more sort of extreme wings of either party that get out there, and they push the parties in a direction that make them a little inaccessible, I guess, to the average Minnesotan.
But then take that to the next step where, all right, so you've had this maybe insider type crowd doing precinct caucuses, becoming delegates to conventions and all of that. They pick their candidate, and then somebody else runs against them in a primary. Well, a primary, more than anything, is a test of who has the most money. Not necessarily a test of that grassroots support. It can be. Or it can be a name ID test. Everyone is different.
Right.
And I think you've seen in Minnesota recently, you've had the Republican nominee held up by the broader swath of voters in a primary, and you've had the DFL candidate struck down in the case of Dayton's first run. It's gone both ways.
There's no question that the grassroots, the endorsement process, the caucus process is more influential and resonates more on the Republican side than it does on the DFL side. I think you can't really argue that here in Minnesota.
I think so. And I think it has a little bit to do with just keep making sure that your voters stay informed and how important that grassroots base of voters are. And I think there's a lot more, there has been more internal maneuvering within a Republican Party recently, though now we're seeing some of those rifts within a party. I think you're seeing the Republicans congeal a little bit more and focus on a core message more. And you're starting to see Democrats ripped apart at the seams a little bit by some of the mining issues, by some of the environmental issues, and even some, I think, tax issues. So there's a lot of work to be done. Bottom line, you have to get involved if you want to have a say in anything that goes on. You have to show up.
And to all of that, Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity, joins us in studio. If you go to AmericansForProsperity.org or if you go to MinnesotaKickoff.com, you guys got a little event coming up on Tuesday, right?
Yeah, well, with the legislative session kicking off, we want to make sure that our activists and the public at large is kind of ready for and has an opportunity to weigh in with leadership on what some of those priorities need to be. So our legislative kickoff is Tuesday, February 13th, so next Thursday. It's in St. Paul at the hotel Kitty Corner there from the state office building in the Capitol. Used to be the Kelly Inn, now the Best Western Plus Capitol Ridge. All the information's online at MinnesotaKickoff.com. But we're going to have some food, some appetizers, some networking time, and then kick off a program where we talk a little bit about our broad legislative priorities in terms of what we want to make sure happens this legislative session and into the future. But then I'm going to moderate a conversation with Speaker of the House, Kurt Dowd, and with Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka, and hear what their priorities are. And then we're going to take some questions from the audience, too. So if you're interested in this legislative session, if you want to know what they're talking about that might get done, you know, or what Dayton might sign, yeah, we're going to ask them that specifically. But then also on any issue that may impact you, you'll have a chance to make your voice heard, too. And a lot more information about Americans for Prosperity there as well.
Have you, just on the national level, any thoughts on the, we were talking about it during Sam's Top 5 this morning, but the budget deal that they're working through and the money being spent, and, you know, Republicans are supposed to not increase the budget and spend as much money, but they are.
And that's my issue. I'm not fully up to speed on it, but here's what I know. We are spending an awful lot of money just to get us to a deal that gets us to, what, mid to late March?
Yeah.
I just, the fact that we keep on having to resort to these continuing resolutions, and the fact that to get those last couple of votes, we need to increase spending the way that they are and abandon some of those principles of reining in the federal government where it needs to be reined in, this deal isn't good in that regard. Now, it's also only till March, and then you revisit, and then you, but if we keep on doing this continuing resolution process and we abandon what the House and Senate really started well at, I think this session was going back to regular order and passing actual real appropriation bills,
right,
and having the conversations in committee about what our priorities are, how we're going to fund it, what reforms need to be made. That's the way to do this budget. We can't keep on getting stuck in this deadline mentality, kicking the can down the road, because then to avoid a shutdown, you're going to start making some bad deals. I think we're seeing that here.
Well, and the problem is that we end up, this even happens for me, because you end up sort of getting sucked into this mentality that suddenly what they've gotten done is a good thing, but that's only because everything they've done before it was crap. So you kind of go, we're heading towards the shutdown. Oh, it shut down, and then, okay, we turned everything back on again. It's like, oh, no, okay, now they got a deal. I know they pushed it a little further, but they got a deal, and you stop and go, no, wait, it's only good because the last thing was so bad.
Right, and I would even give it a little more credit if you made some kind. I'm not against a grand bargain of sorts. I want it to stick to my principles. I don't want it to increase the scope and size of government. But at the very least, if you're going to give up concessions like it looks like they're prepared to give up here,
right,
not for a two-month deal. Let's kick it out then. Make it the full budget cycle, you know, whatever. I forget when the federal fiscal year ends, but make the deal until then. And then deal with this again in the real form that the budget should be dealt in. These little short-term deals, they can't be good for anybody. And we're going to find out later what other little line items are stuck in here, too, because there's always that kind of stuff. It's where they always want to extend other taxes. It's a terrible process.
Tuesday, February 13th, Americans for Prosperity hosting their 2018 session kickoff event. You're going to unveil your priorities for the upcoming session. As you mentioned, you're going to talk with Kurt Dowd, and Paul Gazelka will be there. Anything else you want listeners to know about this, and where can they get more information?
I mean, as always, we've got free food. Gonna have the cash bar up. I mean, I still fall for free food, right?
Heck yeah, man.
That's right. Just leave it that. We're gonna get free food on this night, and hey, we're gonna talk about some stuff too.
Thought you were bringing us on this morning.
Visit MinnesotaKickoff.com for more information. You can always visit our website, AmericansForProsperity.org, or follow us on Twitter @ProsperityMN.
That's coming Tuesday, February 13th. Excellent romantic pre-Valentine's Day event.
That's right. A free food, free event. You do have to register ahead of time, because we need to make sure we have enough room for everybody, but we will let you in if you register ahead of time.
Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity, man. Hey, thanks for coming in this morning.
Happy to be here, guys.
Coming up, we're going to hear from lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien. A fight over Minnesota lieutenant governor has its day in court out of MinnPost. And we've got a Dai Tao update.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to have to make a Dai Tao update. It's kind of a regular thing, I think. It's going to become a bit all on its own.
Yeah, Dai Tao don't mess around.
Dai Tao don't care.
No, he do not
Dai
care.
Dai Tao don't care. Justice.